The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has written a book that will appeal to anyone who has an interest in color, design, art, interior design, advertising, or decorative art. For years, Pantone has set the mark for designers on color selection. The Pantone system of color identification is known as the standard language for identifying, selecting, and matching colors. Now, Pantone consultants Leatrice Eisenman and my guest, Keith Recker, have collaborated on a beautiful book that identifies America's changing color taste and the cultural movements that has defined it. Pantone, the 20th Century in Color, published by Chronicle Books, uses art, objects, and culture to define America's shifting color palette through the century. From Edwardian and arts and crafts influences at the beginning of the century to African grunge and Martha Stewart influences by the 1990s. The book uses seminal images, artworks, and objects that define the style with the Pantone swatches that define the colors. Keith Recker is a color and trend consultant for Pantone. Over the past 20 years, he's used his divine savvy to shape brands, products, and services for numerous companies. And he is currently the editor and founder of Hand Eye Magazine. He joins us today by phone. Keith Recker, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning.
And congratulations on this beautiful, beautiful book. Now, the book seems to be using art, objects, and culture over the past century to define America's shifting color palette. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, you know, my co-author and I have been working with Pantone for a number of years on color matters. And, you know, in discussing resource materials and things that we look at and things that we use for research, we realized nobody had ever gone back and viewed history through the lens of color. And like any cultural discipline, color reveals quite a lot about the people who invent it, the people who use it, the people who get passionate about it. And the 20th century proved to be a pretty rich trove of information based in color.
Now, what does the tendency to use a color tell us about a particular era?
I think basically every era has its emotional, psychological, spiritual hotspots. And some colors, you know, there are certain kinds of red that make us excited and express things about revolutionary attitudes and being on high alert in times of danger. And there are other smoky, earthy, nourishing reds, which just satisfy us and remind us kind of the warm fires of home and of being nourished and settled and comfortable.
There's also a red that would say sex.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that luscious red.
That's right, that scarlet letter red. As a matter of fact, we cover that scarlet letter red in a chapter right in the middle of the book about 1950s cosmetics and how fiery and bold women were able to be in terms of declaring themselves sexy and attractive. And it really was almost a first in the century that you didn't have to be labeled risque and, you know, mildly immoral if you just simply stood front and center and looked extremely beautiful.
What I found interesting about this book was that, you know, rather than having a single color palette that sort of covers an era, there's usually three or four different palettes going on at a given time. But it also follows three or four different movements because there are always different art movements, cultural movements, you know, various objects that come into vogue. And those palettes will stay true within that movement.
Yeah, it's true, actually. It's true that we really paid a lot of attention to capturing the more forward and aggressive palettes, in addition to acknowledging the more classic and familiar and full of propriety kind of palettes. If you just look at the first decade of the 20th century, there's a, we present a little chapter on Edwardian style, which was very much full of propriety and ceremony. If any of your listeners have listened to or watched Downton Abbey on PBS, you see the fashion and the way people lived.
Yeah.
It's very formal. But at the same time, we also had people going over the top with Tiffany coloring and peacock feathers and iridescent glass. And then right on your heels, we have the group of French painters called the Fauves, who were squeezing bright, vivid colors right out of the tube onto their canvas to create the first art revolution of the 20th century.
Yeah, and the Fauve is almost like we're going to take a color that is somewhat contrasting with the real color of the object. I mean, it had nothing to do with the true color of the object. It was about creating this vivid, strong, you know, Fauve is the beast. That's how the art society referred to these guys, because they were just using raw, strong colors.
That's right. They decided that, unlike all the art movements that preceded them, they were going to be uninterested in replicating the real visual experience. And instead, they were engaged really with the paint. They loved their paint, which means they loved their color. And they were just going for bold effect. And their colors are fantastic. The colors are really a pleasure to look at.
And of course, at that same time, you also had the arts and crafts movement, which were using wood, nature tones and earth tones.
Yeah, exactly, which is something, of course, we see coming back in a very interesting way in the 1970s, when the earth movement really took flight in the Western world. And, of course, we see ourselves living with those colors now in the 21st century with all the concern about sustainability and environmental responsibility.
Of course, what this book does is you demonstrate it through the Pantone color swatches, but also through actual objects. I'm on the Arts and Crafts page, and you have this beautiful chandelier from Green and Green from about 1907. Yeah. It's beautiful. It's a classic Arts and Crafts piece. Also, a linen press from an arts and crafts colony, and then a book by Ralph Waldo Emerson, I guess, in a 1905 edition that sort of reflects a lot of these themes. And you find these trends through a variety of forms, not just one. The Fauve page, you obviously have Fauve artwork, but in many cases you'll see another trend that reflects that style in a different sort of part of the culture.
Yeah, we continue that diversity all the way through to the end of the century. So I'm thinking of a chapter from the 1980s where we show a cover of Interview magazine with all of its bold, bright, confident 1980s colors, and right next to it signage from the 1984 Olympics and a Keith Haring drawing. So we maintain an effort all through the book to demonstrate these palettes broadly. Because graphic design is really adventuresome in its grappling with palettes, just like the fine arts. Fashion, the same, and consumer product, too. We were fascinated with some blenders and shavers and appliances from the 20s and 30s because they took Art Deco influences from expensive interiors and buildings and delivered them at affordable prices for consumers. So we're pretty broad church when it comes to accessing imagery.
Now, when you take an era like the 1980s, there were so many different trends. It seems to me it would be very hard to find an overarching palette for a decade like that. Was that an impossible, you know, I'm looking at the 1980s and you have Urban Cowboys. We remember that was the time of the Urban Cowboys. So you have a Calvin Klein ad with Brooke Shields. You have a picture of Larry Hagman as J.R. Ewing, an advertisement for boots. The sign and symbols, which you were talking about, the L.A. Olympics. This is a whole completely... utterly different color palette. The next page is Miami Vice. Remember the 1980s is the year of pastels when they came back.
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially for men, yeah.
So, is it possible to create a color palette for something as large as a decade?
It's not easy, and I think actually the more we become an interconnected global society, the harder it is to do that kind of thing concisely because there's so many impulses in the air all at the same time. In the 80s and 90s, we actually presented 9 color palettes per decade. At the beginning of the century, we presented 7. So we did bend to a little pressure for diversity. It's interesting. The task that was hardest in the book was deciding what we had to leave out just for reasons of space. So you're right. It's quite hard to discipline yourself into narrowing the choices. What we tried to go for were these broad statements. You know, if you look at the 90s, we have a little chapter on grunge and graffiti to acknowledge the economic downturn and the effect that it had, particularly on young people, a little rebellion, a little depression. Mm-hmm. But then we moved quite quickly into acknowledging Martha Stewart's position in the 90s as a leader in all things domestic, interior design, home product, even as we move into looking at Zen and the way minimal design seemed to appear and satisfy in the 90s. we tried to acknowledge these broad psychological things with visuals and colors to capture the era.
I'm looking at one page from the 1980s, which really does capture sort of, and I think when I say this, people will utterly know the colors I'm talking about. And that is Santa Fe from the 1980s. And this goes into the whole Ralph Lauren Western thing, as well as, you know, just this whole infatuation with the desert Southwest. And you have George O'Keefe paintings, as well as a upholstery fabric from the 80s, although the O'Keefes are from, you know, the 1930s. So this is where you see early eras being sort of revived, which is another 20th century sort of cultural phenomenon.
Two things happened in the 80s that bring about this palette. The 70s, of course, embraced avocado green in a big way, and it had, you know, 3-4 years of really intense usage, and then it fell out of favor. And the next color people seemed to focus on in the 80s was mauve. And this kind of earthy, almost mystical, comforting tone that was, you know, almost all the way around the color wheel became extremely popular. Just as that was all taking place, George O'Keefe passed away. And the National Gallery put together a traveling exhibit of her works to acknowledge her life. And it became so wildly popular that these paintings of the 30s that you're looking at in our book really became influential. And there was a re-exploration of her way of looking at nature, her way of coloring nature. And this Southwest palette became immensely influential. It, of course, passed from favor in the 90s. And we had Martha Stewart's take on colors, I think, really become the rage. The kind of garden-derived colors and the colors of 1920s and 30s English and American Revival style. Mm-hmm. So there's always a change in the air. And it's important to kind of put your finger on what it is and where it might be going.
I'm actually looking at the avocado page now, and this is Avocado and Harvest Gold. And you have a J.C. Penney instructional pamphlet, and it's totally an avocado green. We have a shag carpet from it looks like it's what is the color here? It is burnt orange, and a plantation wallpaper pattern, again with avocado, burnt orange, and you know these colors today look, there's only one way to put it, ugly.
Yeah, I think I have to say this is everybody's favorite chapter in the book, because it's one of those moments where we're far enough away from it to be able to look at it objectively, and I agree with your assessment, it's not especially pretty. And it's one of those moments where color really obviously is a factor in our decision-making. The roots of this palette had everything to do with the Earth Movement of the 70s, mm-hmm. and somehow this palette was looked upon as an earthy, nature-derived alternative to the all-white enamel kitchen of our childhoods. And boy, it was intense. It really was. And you saw mushroom-shaped canisters and owl macrame wall hangings popping up right alongside this palette. I think it's great that it only lasted 3 or 4 years. But
you know what? You know what? In that particular era, when you look back to the 1950s and the bright colors, like you have a chapter on coast-to-coast woolens, you know, Fantasyland, the Disneyland influence, abstract expressionism, again, bold colors.
Yep.
Those were probably looked on as ugly as we look on Avocado and Harvest Gold today. And believe it or not, we're starting to return to this color palette. That whole mid-century thing is seeing a revival now.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely true. I think the catwalks, the fashion shows for spring 2012 would deliver quite a lot of these saturated, vivid hues, which is great. I think it's a great message from the world of style that we could be confident, that we could be inventive, and we could be fully on the way to recovery again. I thank the style world for that. And that's fantastic.
Now, you brought that up. People have always said that colors do reflect where we are as, like, our economy. How true do you find that to be? You spent some time researching the 20th century. Is that true, or is that just, you know, something somebody said at one point? It's become an altruism, if you will.
I find that to be incredibly true, actually. If we go back to the 30s, again, we're far enough away from the 30s to be maybe a little cool and analytical about it. We find two strains of color, I think, in the 30s. One is calm, shadowy, and you can call that either reassuring or camouflage. Are we wanting to blend into the background and hunker down and wait out the bad times? Or are we, you know, being conservative and classic and making sure that we can rewear, reuse, live with whatever we purchase for a long time? Alongside that, we see the vivid, bright colors of Monopoly games and Bakelite and other kind of amusing, lower-cost things. Even as we're facing bad times and seeking to hunker down and ride it, occasionally, you know, we have to step out of the hibernation den and feel like we're having a little party because we need to be alive. We need to have the energy to reinvent. We need to have the energy to be creative and get on to the next thing. So both of those needs are expressed in the palettes of the 30s. Think of Wizard of Oz and all of that magic about escaping from the glum Depression era farmstead that Dorothy and Uncle Henry and Aunt Em lived in, and going to Oz with all of those amazing fantasy escapist colors. I think that captures perfectly the duality of the color use of the time.
And the color palette there was everything from spectra yellow to vibrant green, lion, poppy red, bluebell. This is the other thing that your book does, is you actually have color swatches on each page that shows us the color palettes involved and the Pantone colors.
Yeah, we've gotten some great comments about providing those swatches too. It's a useful resource for people creating their own artwork, their own design work, whether you're doing it at home for yourself and for your family, or whether you're doing it at the office for your job. It's great to be able to go back and say, wow, you know, look at that spectra yellow and the colors that surround it. I could take that and use that as the basis for my next project. So it's useful. The book is quite useful as well.
My guest today is Keith Recker, a color and trend consultant for Pantone, and he is also the editor and founder of Hand Eye Magazine. He is co-author with Leatrice Eisman of Pantone, The 20th Century in Color. And this must have been a fun project, because not only are you coming up with these categories, which some sort of exist, and others I think are sort of maybe your invention, I have to say, for a particular era and a sort of a color combination that was popular for a few years. Tell us about actually deciding what sort of objects, what sort of artworks, what sort of illustrations were going to go into the books to demonstrate these color palettes.
Well, it's probably a three-phase process. You know, there's the fantasy process where you're looking at random through books and websites and museum exhibits, museum catalogs, that kind of thing, assembling your kind of fantasy museum of color. And then there's the practicality of it. What can you actually chase down in good enough to print photographs that you can actually have the rights to reproduce? And then in the end, there's that final editing. How do you get to basically three colors per spread? So there's a heavy editing process. And you know, basically, Leatrice and I and the publisher sort of walk through that process together. You know, sometimes a few things are sacrificed, and other times you think, wow, you know, we really delivered. We really did it. The 1950s palette that I was mentioning earlier with these vivid reds, which is called Cosmetic Superstars, fabulous palette. And it was one of the examples of how something just falls together so easily. We found this great ad campaign from Revlon called Fire and Ice. And it was a Richard Avedon photograph, you know, famous photographer, of Dorian Lee, who was the world's first supermodel, showing off her super red lipstick and her super red nail polish from Revlon. And boy, once you get that major influence so perfectly expressed, the rest just falls into place.
Yeah, that is a beautiful, beautiful advertisement. And then you have a red dress, sort of ruby-styled costume jewelry that sort of fill out the page.
Yeah, the dress is another great story. There are some seminal American talents that we don't often talk about in mainstream these days, and that red dress was designed by somebody named Claire Cardell, who was extremely influential in inventing the ready-to-wear market, the American ready-to-wear market, the way we see it today. She was really inventive. She had this sort of classic American sense of not too many frills, not much waist, sensible, but she managed to hone that into a beautiful kind of glamour.
Mm.
Very talented lady.
It's interesting. Illustrationists also sort of take a big role in the early part of the century, not so much in the latter part because photography replaces it, but the Maxfield Parrishes and Leyendecker and these important illustration artists, these had a big impact on color, didn't they?
Oh, they sure did. They were really influential. When you think of the explosion of the printed magazine at the beginning of the century, photography was expensive to reproduce. I mean, if they could produce it at all at the beginning. So you had Maxfield Parrish and the inventor of the Kewpie, Rose O'Neill, and Leyendecker, who really focused on menswear and men's advertisements. People saw their images in profusion and consistently. There's some amazing figure of the number of Saturday Evening Post covers that Leyendecker drew. That's astonishing. So they really did, I think, help shape the aesthetic of the era. When Leyendecker, apparently he's the one who suggested that the Arrow Shirt Company invent a figure called the Arrow Man, and the Arrow Man became this seminal icon of American masculinity. The fit, athletic, well-groomed, composed, cool, calm, collected, and that still endures, actually.
Mm. My guest today is Keith Recker, co-author of Pantone, The 20th Century in Color, which follows arts and trends throughout the 20th century from the aughts of 1900 through the 1990s, showing off various cultural art movements and the colors and the color palette through Pantone colors that sort of describe that. One of the things, two pages I really enjoyed, one was in the 1920s and 1930s, and this is sort of my own personal enjoyment. I love the old 1920s and 30s travel posters, and you have destinations as a page. These great illustrations, again, very vivid, fairly vivid colors from the 1920s. The 1930s, you have a lot of the WPA parks and recreation posters. We think of the great national park series of WPA posters to encourage travel in the United States to get the economy moving. And again, earth palettes there.
That's I think Leatris and I agree. That's one of our favorite spreads in the book too. The Parks and Recreation chapter. Yeah, I'm so happy that the travel posters come across in that chapter is so stirring and so majestic, because if you think of the way that our country responded to the Great Depression, so much was created when we could have lost everything. You know, there's so many projects, public architecture. There was a project that employed American artists, and many of the people who became household names, like Mark Rothko and Jackson Pollock, were supported for a short period of time by the Federal Art Project. It's a great testament to how coherent our response to the great difficulty was. We really behaved well from a cultural point of view at that time.
Another page that sort of caught my attention for its perhaps its lack of vividness, but it is an important cultural movement in the late 1940s, is film noir. And the color palette is interesting, shocking, because it's basically grays, beiges, and almost black, and then blood red.
Oh, yeah, that blood red, we show a movie poster for Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, and that blood red is quite clear. In the typography of the poster. Yeah, of course, making a color palette out of black and white movies might seem a little suspect, but that severe style that you see in film noir is still, I think, something memorable, and it did say something funny about the psychology of the era. Film noir, with all of that sort of duplicitousness and treachery, was unfolding at the same time as McCarthy's Red Scare. Where the country went into a little bit of a panic based on pretty much nothing. So the psychological resonance of film noir was important. And I think the addition of this red, which is called High Risk Red,
yes,
by Pantone, I think that was pretty key. We love that palette. It's a great non-color palette.
Yeah, and then the names of, Raven for the black, gold gray, ash, white sand, and then High Risk Red. And that's the interesting thing is you actually look at the colors through the Pantone names. And many times you see that the Pantone color name actually sort of reflects the movement in many ways, like that high-risk red.
Yeah. I have to say that's something my co-author, Leatrice, has really been instrumental in at Pantone. She's been with Pantone for quite a number of years. And she's really always looked to be able to describe the effects of the color in their name, and, of course, in combination with other colors as well. So the names have become very important. We love that.
Of course, in the 1960s, I'm looking at colors and coordinates. This is one of the few times where there actually are no names for the colors. And the colors are that vibrant 60s, a sort of medium blue, a very strong yellow, a dark pink, a bright orange, a little lighter than avocado green, a red-orange, as well as a light blue. That's a part of that palette. That sort of talks about that sort of idea of, you know, that was a time when we were using these sort of colors just for color statements.
Yeah, happy, bold, expressive colors. Yeah, the main illustration on that spread is from Vera, of Vera Scarf fame. And you remember those happy prints and her kind of effortless sketching style, very effervescent, very bubbly. It was a nice time, but, you know, it's a very nice impulse to capture in color. Very bubbly, very carefree. And the colors that don't have names, Rich, are actually from the Pantone matching system, which is the original Pantone system invented in 1963, which was really for use by printers. And the colors that have names came later as a part of the fashion and home system, which are textile-based. So the ones that have names are the ones that are mostly used by design professionals outside of printing.
Let me ask you, after spending so much time with these various color palettes, has this sort of changed the way you look at color and how you use color in your own work?
It's interesting. One of the things that working on the book did is it made us both, I think, much more conscious of the cycling in and out of key colors as well as the palettes that surround them. You mentioned the Miami Vice chapter from the 80s. It was really interesting to me to see how it related so strongly to the chapter called Theatrics, which focuses on the work of Leon Bakst and the Ballet Russe in the second decade of the 20th century. There are some important coordinates there. And I thought, wow, the act of being a color revolutionary often means simple revival, not wild invention. So Miami Vice guys with their pastels looked a lot like some of the color palettes used in the Ballet Russe for Scheherazade and Afternoon of a Faun and those revolutionary ballets by Diaghilev and Nijinsky and all those fantastic people who were part of that group.
Interesting. Maybe there's hope for Avocado and Harvest Gold yet.
Not yet. I don't think we're ready just yet.
The name of the book is Pantone, the 20th Century in Color. Keith Recker, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Keith Recker is a color and trend consultant for Pantone and the co-author of Pantone, the 20th Century in Color. It's published by Chronicle Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.